This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Brian Becker reports from the nation's capital on policing of protest and police accountability.
The place looks like a war zone in Iraq. Demonstrations have been banned in Washington, D.C. Let's hear from Brian on what the story is.
Professor Jack Rasmus tells us how deep the crisis of our limited democracy is.
It's plenty deep. It doesn't look like the government's going to come up with anything that's going to adequately solve the terrific, and it doesn't look like the government's going to come up with anything that's going to adequately solve the numerous problems that we have.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
When Bush opened up the offshore prison camp at Guantanamo, Obama vowed to close it. He never did. It's still open. Prisoners are still there. It still remains a threat to us. Obama said, we've got to look forward, not backward. Is Biden going to do the same thing? Let's hear from Jim Lafferty, the former director of the National Lawyers Guild out in California, with his thoughts on that subject.
40 suspects remain in the United States prison on Guantanamo Bay, or Gitmo, as it's commonly known. And nobody can reasonably predict when, if ever, they will be freed or be afforded a trial with any measure of due process. In 2008, the Supreme Court in Bomadine v. Bush held that the Gitmo prisoners' access to federal court was not only a statutory right, but that the prisoners also had the right in federal court to bring a writ of habeas corpus. But it left open the question of what rights, by filing such a writ, did the prisoners have? Did they, most critically, have the right to due process of law in their trials? Well, that question was answered last month and answered in the negative in the case of Al-Hela v. Trump, a case out of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, where most Gitmo cases are decided. It ruled that Gitmo prisoners have no right to due process, period. And, of course, there is no reason to think today's Supreme Court will overturn that decision. Once a front-page story, the U.S. prison on Guantanamo Bay is seldom in the news these days, or apparently on the minds of the American people. Well, it should be. The history and ongoing operation of Gitmo exposes the lie behind our claim to be a nation governed by the rule of law, condemned by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and many other such groups. It is a permanent stain on the character of the American people. Gitmo began taking in suspected enemy combatants from Al-Qaeda in 2002. At the height of its operation, close to 800 quote-unquote suspects from many different Muslim nations were held there under torturous conditions without any due process of law. The youngest was 13 years old. In fact, 21 of the detainees were children. Dozens of detainees were tortured. Many committed suicides. Over 500 were convicted in sham federal court trials and others in illegitimate military tribunals. Many, if not most, suspects clearly bore no responsibility for combat operations in the Muslim nations where we were waging war, and in some cases still are waging war. I feel the same way about this shameful piece of American history, as does Linda Greenhouse, the brilliant reporter on the rulings of the Supreme Court on NPR. Ms. Greenhouse recently wrote, and I quote, "I've come to think of Guantanamo, born in fear and sustained through political cynicism and public indifference, as a mirror of ourselves during these opening decades of the current century, trapped no less than our 40 remaining forever prisoners with no obvious end to their imprisonment," close quote. And I would add, no obvious end to the U.S. imperialism carried out by both U.S. capitalist parties, and that is responsible for the shame of Gitmo in the first place. Our wars in the Middle East have been wars on Muslims for the purpose of getting their oil. And so our presidents have claimed we're not at all at war with Muslims, not at war with Islam. Well, tell that to the families of the millions of dead and wounded Muslims our bombings and invasions of Iraq and elsewhere have caused. Tell it to the tens of thousands forbidden to enter America through travel bans. Tell it to the countless numbers of Muslim citizens and residents here in America who've been discriminated against at work or in public. Tell it to the Muslim children attacked on their way to school and called terrorists. Tell it to the Muslim worshipers whose mosques have been infiltrated by governmental agents. America's governing administrations love to preach about human rights abroad. Hell, they even claim they invade other countries to bring human rights and democracy to the countries they invade. Many, even those claiming to be liberals, supported the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan as an opportunity to bring democracy and human rights to those countries. American history is filled with examples of our racist nation looking down on the cultures of the countries we invade as we proclaim our desire to bring human rights to those countries. It is a lie. They are invaded only for geopolitical advantage and for the rich resources those countries contain. Make no mistake about it. It is because the men held in Guantanamo are prisoners and people of color and seem to be of an inferior culture to the white Western culture of America that allows America to continue holding those still in Guantanamo with no end in sight to their imprisonment or to our immorality and shame. I urge all who hear this to contact their congressional representatives, demanding freedom for all those still being held at Gitmo, and demanding that our country return them to their countries of origin or to any other suitable country who will take them, and demanding as well that Gitmo itself be permanently closed. Only by keeping the American people aware of this shameful story and then mobilizing ourselves to bring sufficient pressure on our government to finally close Gitmo, well, we have finally gone some distance towards lessening this blight on our nation and on ourselves.
Throughout history, Americans have protested incoming presidents. 4 years ago, thousands descended on the nation's capital to protest Donald Trump's inauguration, and more than 200 were arrested. The day before President Woodrow Wilson took office in 1913, up to 8,000 women marched down Pennsylvania Avenue in what one historian says was likely the first large-scale inauguration protest. The suffragists, who'd gotten a parade permit, were pushed, spat on, and beaten. Many women were hospitalized, and the treatment of women led to the firing of the Capitol's police chief. In 1969, anti-war protesters threw burning miniature flags and stones at police during Richard Nixon's inauguration. During his 1973 inauguration, a massive anti-war protest was staged at the Lincoln Memorial, with an estimated 100,000 people present. 80 congressmen joined the demonstrations and boycotted the inaugural ceremonies. Demonstration at George W. Bush's inauguration in 2001 were the first major protests at a presidential inauguration since those against Nixon. At least 20,000 people demonstrated in the Capitol and along the inaugural parade route in defiance of the Supreme Court ruling in Bush v. Gore. 2 weeks before the Biden inauguration, Trump-loving lawbreakers ransacked the Capitol building. Combined with the COVID pandemic, that meant that last week's inauguration was pared down and a ring of law enforcement encircled the metropolis. Here to tell us what it was like on Inauguration Day in D.C. and what the future of policing there may look like is Brian Becker. Brian is the director of the National Answer Coalition and host of the Socialist Program News Podcast. Brian Becker, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
We didn't see any signs of protest in the sanitized television coverage of last week's inauguration. Were there any? And if so, where were they?
In fact, there were not. At the last minute, the day before the inauguration, the Answer Coalition, which I'm the national director of, was given a permit for a part of the Pennsylvania Avenue around the Navy Memorial for a crowd of less than 100 people. There was no possible way for people to actually enter the area because it's a completely locked down, occupied zone. And there was no permission for media to come to us either. And even the presidential-elect sort of caravan that comes down normally Pennsylvania Avenue was rerouted to go down Constitution Avenue. So even that small protest, should it have happened, would have not had even a sight or sound connections to the incoming administration. So on the basis of this mirage of free speech, given a permit for a demonstration that would have actually no meaning, we decided not to go forward with it.
Brian, set the overall scene for us, please. In the days leading up to the transfer of power, I understand that there were concrete barriers, chain link fences, and military trucks. Did it feel like a military state?
I'd have to say that the image of the United States has been shattered. The image of an omnipotent form of American governance, that image that's so important for the United States, which functions as an anchor to a world system. It is the dominant power. It projects its image as a system that's durable, that even if it has crises, economic crises or lost wars, that the system of governance itself is something that everyone can count on. That's been shattered. And coming as it does here at the inauguration, where the entire city is under lockdown, where it looks, again, like the green zone in occupied Baghdad, coming as it does just 2 weeks after a fascist-led mob was able to disperse the Congress, disperse the seat of government, force them to go into hiding. At the moment, they were lawfully required to certify the election outcome. When you take these two events together, it's shattering in terms of the U.S. Image globally.
Now, Brian, as you well know, the powers that be always do their best to quash dissent from critics of their administration. What do you say to commentators who justify this lockdown as a legitimate way to deter pro-Trump rioters in the wake of the prior attacks a couple of weeks ago?
Well, it's a complicated question, actually, because we know that whenever the state and the government aggregate more powers to suppress dissent, whether it's in order to suppress forces on the right or perhaps others, ultimately the government's predisposition is to use that aggregated state power to suppress dissent from the left, from the working class, from the poor, from Black and Latino and immigrant communities. So we are very concerned that the precedent that's being set right now here in Washington, D.C., where protest has been made basically not available to the public, where dissent has been banished for all intents and purposes, that sets a dangerous precedent. At the same time, what happened on January 6th was stunning. It was shocking to the powers that be and perhaps to the country as a whole. A Trump-led, a mob led by the president of the United States using violent methods, heavily armed, including many, many firearms, able to storm the center of government and disperse it, that's not a small matter. So you can't really have an event like what happened on January 6th without expecting that the government, unless it broke apart into factional division, which at some point seemed possible, you would expect that the government would do something to regain control over the street. And there was a growing rising tide of fascist, violent, white supremacist, fascist movement building here in Washington, D.C. that engaged in a seditious conspiracy. So it's somewhat expected on the part of the government. And at the same time, as I said, it sets a dangerous precedent because aggregated power by the government isn't given away by the government at a later time. We have to fight for our right to be, our right to protest, our right to dissent, our right to engage in First Amendment protected activities.
So how many law enforcement agents were there in town, Brian? in the last couple of weeks. There were a lot of them. How many? Who were they? Where'd they come from? Who ordered them out?
In terms of law enforcement, it's National Guard from many, many states. It's 25,000 guardsmen have occupied D.C. They are heavily armed. In addition, you have the Capitol Police, who did a very poor job, to put it mildly, at defending the Capitol on January 6th. That's a force of 2,300. You have the Metropolitan Police Department, several thousand police officers. The Park Police, that's under the Interior Department, the State Department Police. Of course, there's the FBI, there's the CIA. Nearby Arlington, Virginia Police, Alexandria Police, State Police from Virginia. Likewise, Montgomery County, Maryland Police, Prince George's County Police, State of Maryland Police. There are so many police agencies here. In the district, in normal times, there's more than 20 police agencies. This is the most policed place in the country, maybe anywhere in the world. And that makes the takeover of the Capitol building even more astounding. Like, how could it be that the Capitol, where the Congress sits, was so vulnerable in spite of all of the warnings that right-wing fascists were coming with guns in hand to breach the Capitol? All of these police forces are here now, but they weren't there then at a critical moment.
You've been at several inaugurations over the past few decades, and you've organized protests, you've watched violent police treatment of peaceful individuals coming from around the nation to let their voices be heard. Tell us what you think the inauguration might have looked like if there hadn't been that storming of the Capitol 2 weeks ago. As you've just said, there is obviously an enormous police presence in D.C., but do you think we would have seen protesters akin to the way we did for every most previous inaugurations?
Yes, I do. The Answer Coalition, which stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, which organized the big protests against the Iraq War here in Washington, but also, as you mentioned, Heidi, we have organized very, very large protests at every inauguration for the last 20 years. On January 20th, 2017, the first Trump, or the only Trump inauguration, we had a demonstration of 15,000. We had permits for demonstrations for tens of thousands of people here on January 20th. We applied for those permits more than a year ago. The first time the Park Service actually met with us about our permit applications, though, was 1 week ago. 1 week ago was the first time. And then they informed us that big parts of the Capitol were not going to be available for public gatherings. Then they told us that the largest assembly we could have would be 100 people. Then they told us that the access, the people who came had to be vetted by Secret Service or FBI, so we had to give them the names of the people who might be joining us, or at least be able to bring them to a checkpoint and verify and validate them with Secret Service and FBI that these would be the allowed protesters. I mean, if it hadn't been for these restrictions, there would have been large protests, and the protests would have been against whether it was Trump or Biden, because the fact of the matter is we were coming to Washington to say, look, COVID, because of government failures and the way it was managed, led to 61 million people filing for unemployment insurance since March. 400,000 Americans have died. People still don't have adequate health care. Students are still, under this enormous staggering student debt. There's so much that has to be talked about. And the new administration, say if it's the Democrats, Biden, they control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House. They can do whatever they want to do. We were going to be in the streets saying cancel student debt, cancel rents, not just a moratorium on evictions, but cancel rents, and make sure that every human being in the United States has health care. Not to mention large financial subsidies for the growing part of the population that is hungry. 50 million Americans now, according to the recent surveys, 50 million people in the richest country in the world are now food insecure, which is just a euphemism for being hungry.
Let's talk about the police accountability in D.C. after what happened. What changes, if any, do you predict will happen in the near future? Will there be any meaningful shakeup?
Well, there was a raft of resignations from the Capitol Police, the sergeant at arms of the House, the sergeant at arms of the Senate. But besides those like high profile resignations, and a few people, of course, would have to take responsibility for it. If anything, I think this event on January 6th, again, poorly managed or deliberately mismanaged by forces in the police and the military, who I think were colluding with the mob. That's going to be used as a pretext for new repressive measures on the basis that this scared the government. This was a wake-up call. The government and the police have to get tough. Biden is saying, you know, we need a domestic anti-terrorism law in order to go after people who are ideologically motivated. That's really dangerous. I mean, if there was a seditious conspiracy, which there was, and if the president of the United States was the chief instigator of the seditious conspiracy, those involved in the seditious conspiracy could be charged with the existing seditious conspiracy laws that, you know, have a 20-year imprisonment penalty. You don't need new laws. Again, all the laws that are necessary to stop something like that from happening or to punish those who are responsible. But instead, you hear the Biden administration and the Democrats talking about new anti-terrorism laws. Let's just remember, after September 11th, the Patriot Act and all of the other draconian measures that were taken, not against the people who perpetrated the crime, but against Muslim communities, against Arab Americans, against South Asians. I think we should be very, very concerned that that's what's on the government's agenda now.
It's an excellent point, Brian. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the extent to which white supremacism pervades law enforcement and the military, and what that has meant in recent past.
It's a very important question, and I think we can see that there are fascist organizations like Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters. They have recruited thousands of military veterans, active duty GIs, and a very large number of police officers. And when you think back to the history of this country, the mob, the racist mob, like the one we saw on January 6th, has always existed in America. And it's always existed as an auxiliary to existing police departments, many of whose personnel were interchangeable. So in the South, the police state that reigned against black people, that was, you know, to accomplish white supremacist goals and to maintain Jim Crow apartheid. And the Klansmen carried out lynchings and other forms of terror against black people, but many of the Klansmen were cops. And the whole genesis of law enforcement and policing in the United States, especially given the system of slavery as a primary form of labor in America, it needed cops. And it needed the mob, the lynch mob, and it needed auxiliary terrorist organizations like the Klan. And I think we see and are seeing especially this resurgence during the Trump period of the same phenomena. And we know that there are large numbers of police officers, retired police officers, military veterans, and active duty GIs who were involved in the January 6th mob. And the attack on the Congress, by the way, was highly coordinated, and it was of a military type. I mean, we've done a lot of research now. We know a lot about what actually happened. These were police and military operations. Not everybody in the crowd was, you know, part of the assault. Many were just, you know, along for the ride. But the assaulters had a lot of police, plainclothes police, off-duty police in their ranks. And white supremacist organizations are actively recruiting within police departments all over the country.
We're talking with Brian Becker, who's the director of the Answer Coalition and the host of the Socialist Program News Podcast. Brian, are investigators focused solely on identifying and finding persons involved in the Capitol attack, or are they cracking down on all politically active people?
Well, right now, it's a blanket ban on protests. So you know, the fascist assault of the Congress, but the left is deprived of its right to speak to the incoming administration and say, as I said before, there's these unmet, you know, dire social and economic problems in America. Right now in Washington, D.C., protest is verboten. I mean, it's out of the question. You can't do it. And I think that's a real problem, and I think that's going to be a real problem going forward. Like millions of Americans, I too was, you know, completely opposed to the white supremacist fascist attack on Congress. But that can't be the pretext, the reason, the rationale for suppressing dissent going forward, especially in the context that we already see in states around the country, all of these anti-protest laws where protest is being literally criminalized, where people are being charged with heavy-duty felonies for things that are traditionally considered fundamental to protest grassroots protest movements. So we're in a dangerous period in American history where, again, without free speech, without dissent, without the right to protest, the hope for real change vanishes, because change really has always come from below.
Brian, that leads nicely into the next question, which is, going forward, what do you think the state of protest on a practical level will look like in D.C.? Will there be a difficulty in obtaining permits? Will people be afraid to come? What do you expect?
Well, in the last 6 months, Washington, D.C. has been a center for all kinds of mass protests. In the aftermath of the George Floyd killing, there were a lot of people came out, tens of thousands came out. We were tear gassed, we were pepper sprayed, we were hit with stinger grenades, rubber bullets, you name it, by all these different police agencies. And yet people kept coming and coming and coming. Those protests got larger. So in one way, I'm optimistic that the spirit of the people, which was, you know, clearly manifested in these mass assembly protests here and around the country, will continue, can continue in spite of police repression. The police used tear gas against protesters in 107 cities. I mean, can you imagine if this was Russia or China, like what the media headlines would be about that? But you know, we had all, the protests kept going. Now, then the protest movement ebbed a little bit. And then the fascist movement after the election sort of gained the momentum in the streets. But I think that fascist movement now, because they overreached in their failed effort to disperse Congress, they're sort of in retreat right now. And I think that unless the Biden administration takes very, very strong measures to deal with the problems that people are having, there will be a lot of protests from the right and the left in the coming period. Will it be possible to get permits in D.C.? Well, you know, because of the litigation from constitutional rights attorneys like the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, you don't even need a permit from the District of Columbia to have a street protest. The rules of protest have been, you know, expanded. There's been an expansion of democracy here in normal times, not in the last 2 weeks. At the same time, the litigation filed by PCJF and others, but mainly PCJF against the park, service and the Interior Department, also means that the permitting process in Washington, D.C. is fairly democratic, first come, first serve. But the big problem in D.C. is big parts of the city are just being shut down. So if Lafayette Park is shut down, which is the, you know, place where people traditionally protest at the White House, if it's literally locked down by Secret Service, which has been happening more and more, you might be able to get a permit, you know, at one level, but not really, not if the park is inaccessible. And I think that's the big issue in Washington. Will there be these unscalable fences that will start to go around all the government buildings such that protests really can't be within sight and sound of the target of the protest? That's the worrying part.
Brian Becker, what are your final thoughts? We're unfortunately running out of time, but how would you wrap up the situation as you see it right now?
Well, we've just gone through an extraordinary moment in American history, an unprecedented, violent assault on the seat of government that took place, I believe, with the collusion of at least some within the police command and some within the military command who refused to deploy National Guard and There was no cordon, no established security parameter such that it would have prevented this takeover of the Capitol. And it was led by fascists. It was led by violent fascists who have been gaining strength and who saw Donald Trump as their leader. They carried out this assault. They partly succeeded, but now they are in retreat. Trump has disowned them because he's trying to save his own skin. Trump seems to be isolated at the moment. Again, Trump as a person was very, very important for the rise of this fascist movement. He was their leader, even though he's not ideologically a Nazi. He is a white supremacist, but he's not ideologically a fascist, but he was using them and they were using him. That relationship has severed right now. So that's an important development. But the big issue coming forward for America and for the American people is what's going to happen to all of the people who have lost their jobs, lost their savings, who have been destroyed because of government failures on COVID-19 and the government's refusal to do what other governments around the world did, which prevented mass layoffs. And so hunger is growing. Bankruptcies will grow. People can't go to a doctor even in the middle of a pandemic. So I think we're going into a period of intensified class struggle, intensified political struggle. And again, we have to build a people's movement, and the people's movement needs the protection of those who believe that the First Amendment is not only a cherished right, but the absolute, you know, foundational catalyst, the floor on which protest movements and free speech movements are able to have air to breathe and light to see. So I think we're involved in an epic battle going forward right in the next month and certainly in the next few years.
Brian, and you are one of our favorite leaders in that epic battle on the side of the First Amendment and our other rights. How can listeners follow you? And tell us very briefly about your podcast.
Sure. My Twitter handle is Brian Becker 6, and Brian is B-R-I-A-N, Becker 6. But you can also subscribe to or listen to our podcast, which is called The Socialist Program. It comes out 3 days a week. We hope to expand it soon. We will with more support. We're independently hosted. You can find us on any of the podcast platforms, Anchor, iTunes, iHeart, Spotify, you name it. You can find the Socialist Program. And again, we have a news and analysis show on Tuesday that goes for about an hour. On Wednesdays, every Wednesday, I have a conversation with Professor Richard Wolff, well-known socialist economist. And on Thursdays, we do a deep dive on the big historical and political issues that are shaping the world going forward. So we're excited about the team. We're excited about the podcast. And soon, we hope, with enough support, we'll be going 5 days a week.
Brian Becker, it's always a pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The word chaos best describes the current American situation: public health, an economic disaster, institutional racism, political turbulence. They're all rampant as Trump vacated the White House. America leads the world in the number of COVID-19 cases. The number of deaths, which are now over 400,000, are mounting rapidly. The economy is in terrible shape. Perhaps 20 million people are unemployed. Small businesses are shuttered. Millions face eviction. Hunger is rampant, especially among children. What does the future hold? Are we really free of Trump and Trumpism? What will Biden do? Centrist Democrats like Biden, since the remaking of the Democratic Party beginning with neoliberal Clinton, have not vigorously defended the social gains secured in the 1930s when Roosevelt brought in the New Deal. Will Biden defend these social gains? Will he extend them? Can he do this by governing from the center? What does his proposed $1.9 trillion rescue package consist of? Will Biden's proposals hold up in Congress? Is there more needed? We speak today with Dr. Jack Rasmus. He holds a Ph.D. in political economy and teaches at St. Mary's College in California. Professor Rasmus has written numerous books and articles on economics and is the host of the weekly radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network.
Professor Jack Rasmus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
How bad are things?
Well, you know, I've been writing and saying for months now that the U.S. is mired in at least a triple crisis, maybe a quadruple crisis. One, of course, is the economy. The second is the COVID health problem. They are interrelated, but they are also independent of each other. It's not just a COVID recession that's going on. And then, of course, the political instability, the third leg of this, which we've been seeing here quite a bit. And that's not going to go away. It'll take other forms now that Biden's in office. And then, of course, the race issue here, which is going to express itself, I believe, here. I don't think the folks that are concerned about institutional racism are going to go away either. So we have at least four crises going on at the same time. And looming beyond that, I think if this thing is not put to bed here economically in another 6 to 12 months, we may even have a financial crisis erupting as the debt builds up and people are unable to service that debt. That could happen as well. So it's not the best of situations. And contrary to what they're saying in Washington, this thing is getting worse, not better. For example, the economy. We're going to be shocked here when we see GDP numbers for the fourth quarter. As I've recently written, consumer spending is dropping off the cliff here in the fourth quarter. And there are other economic indicators. We see this with the rising unemployment claims. The last one was 1.4 million new filings in 1 week, up from, quote, a low of 1 million only in December. So unemployment, as an indicator, is getting worse. Consumer spending is getting worse. Trade and other indicators are getting worse. You know, what we got here in the first quarter, I believe, is going to be even weaker than the fourth quarter of last year, because there's no real stimulus going on. And despite Biden's $1.9 trillion, we can talk about that, you're not going to see much impact of that until well after the first quarter. They won't even, I predict, pass some kind of legislation, and it won't be as much as $1.9 until April. March, April, you won't see any impact on the economy of whatever stimulus they come up with until the second quarter of this year. So this first quarter is going to be a bust. And even Chase Bank Research has predicted we're going to have a contraction this quarter, first quarter here. So, clearly a double-dip recession that I predicted last March would occur here, because this is a great recession, and double and triple-dip recessions are an indicator of great, great recession. Politically, it looks like they've got it a little bit tamed here as far as Washington is concerned, but the right-wing neo-fascist reaction will now move, I think, to the hinterlands. So this problem is not over by any means. And on all three categories, I think we can expect, quite possibly the thing will get worse economically. Health-wise, COVID, they've botched the rollout here, and there's no more vaccines. People are a bit shocked. But this so-called war on the COVID, and it is a war, but I believe the U.S. has been losing that war. We've got 400,000 dead in less than a year, which is equivalent to 3 and almost 4 years of U.S. losses during the entire World War II, 400,000. So this is a war where, the commander-in-chief has been AWOL for a whole year. And where it's like, if the vaccines are ammunition, we're like doling out a bullet at a time to the frontline troops. So that war is not going well. And I think there's a bigger worry, maybe, at the risk of sounding alarmist, that maybe these new strains will not respond as well to the vaccine. And if so, then we are in a bigger world of hurt. So on all levels here, economic and health level and political instability, it's getting worse. It's not getting better. And we got a lot of nice words coming out of the inauguration, you know, but those are just words. We'll see what actually happens.
Jack, talk about Biden's proposals, please. What do they consist of? Are they adequate?
Well, $1.9 trillion, if they actually did spend $1.9 trillion and quickly, could have a significant effect. You know, I've been arguing since last March that what was needed was a quick $4 trillion fiscal stimulus. And, of course, we didn't get that with the CARES Act last March. We really only got about a $1.4 trillion. The rest of the money was not spent, or it was supposed to be spent by business, but it wasn't. And then there's like $650 billion tax cuts for business investors that didn't have any effect. So we only had, you know, a little over $1 trillion of stimulus, so that $4 trillion that was necessary. Then they spent this $900 billion in December, but a good part of that is just continued level of spending, not net new spending. So now we've got $1.9 trillion. But as I wrote in my recent piece here, that you're not going to see $1.9 trillion. The Republicans are blocking with the Democrats. You know, Schumer and McConnell have cut a deal where they're going to share 50-50 on the committees. And, you know, Biden has said he will not go the budget reconciliation route where all you need is a simple majority in order to pass legislation. So that means that the Republicans, McConnell and friends, have a virtual veto. It's like a silent veto over this legislation. And they will really chip away significantly at this $1.9 trillion. Well, what's in the $1.9 trillion? Well, there's $400 billion for fighting COVID and reopening the schools. $170 billion for reopening the schools out of that. And $70 billion in emergency paid leave for, you know, essential workers and people who have to leave work in order to take care of kids and remote learning and people who have to quarantine and people who have to take care of elderly sick and so forth. Well, the Republicans are going to really whack away at that $170 billion for schools and that $70 billion for emergency paid leave. In the second element of that $1.9 trillion is $1 trillion that's allocated for family, direct family leave. That's where you have the $1,400 checks and the extended unemployment benefits and a whole host of other features there or provisions, you know, that are necessary, like, you know, helping people being evicted and rent assistance and food assistance, child care assistance, and tax cuts, child care tax cuts for working families. Well, the Republicans will go after several of those elements with tooth and nail here. You know, they've been arguing that, that's deficit busting. Yeah, these are the same people who have agreed to $5 trillion in tax cuts ever since Trump came in office. And now they're worried about deficit busting here for people who need some. So, you know, the $1,400 checks will be attacked. The expanded unemployment benefits will be attacked. The child care credits will be attacked. And then the final, third section of this, $440 billion of this $1.9 trillion, is really where they're going to go after it. And that's really state and local government support here. You know, $350 billion for state and local government emergency funds in order to keep workers, public workers on the job to distribute vaccines and testing and school reopening and all that. And $20 billion for public transport, you know, so that workers can continue to go to jobs here in the big cities in particular, and tribal government assistance, you know, to help with the pandemic. $390 billion of that $440 billion is going to be the main target because McConnell and Republicans have always felt that whatever goes to state and local government is wasted. They don't want to agree to anything. They haven't, since last June, agreed to any aid to state and local government. And now with McConnell, you know, in a catbird seat, he's not the majority leader anymore, but he's got 50% of all the committees, and he's got this bipartisan deal with Biden. They're going to take a big whack out of this $1.9 trillion. You won't see $1.9 trillion. It'll take at least $500 billion out. And also, some of the remaining $1.9 trillion is really just continuation of spending, not net new stimulus. You know, the unemployment benefits don't kick in until the current unemployment benefits expire in March. So that will be six more months of unemployment benefits. Now, you know, that money will help mitigate any further decline in the economy, but it's not really net stimulus. And there are other provisions as well that aren't net stimulus, new. And then the third problem with the $1.9 trillion, as I said, is that it's not going to get in the economy very quickly, and they desperately need it like yesterday. This thing won't hit the economy until, you know, April, May. And that could mean this quarter would be very, very weak here. You know, could be, as Chase Bank has said, an actual contraction of the economy, even in technical GDP terms. Those are the provisions, I think, that we see in the $1.9 trillion. The Republicans are going to go after at least $500 to $700 billion of it, try to get it out of there. So this thing could be closer to half of the $1.9 trillion. Before it actually occurs. And again, some of that is just continued spending, and it's going to be late. So I'm not very optimistic about this $1.9 trillion.
What do you think the long-range strategy of the right is?
Well, you know, the right is not truly unified. You've got all kinds of radical street versions, you know, the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Proud Boys, and so forth, and they're not all in agreement. And then the right is, of course, embedded in the Republican Party quite deeply, and in the institutions in Congress, and certainly in the state houses, many of them across the country. So what I see is that you will have the right try to spend some time to unify itself here. It's certainly not going to go away. You know, the Cruises and the Hawleys and others will, you know, attempt to do what they can to bring these forces together. You know, the show of military force in Washington, you know, was very predictable here. What you've got is the ruling political elite shaken to the core with what happened here. You know, for the first time, they got to experience what a lot of you know, grade school kids experience when you got a shooter who raids the school and starts you know, knocking everybody off. So you know, their consciousness has changed, but I think they realize that it's not just those people who were, you know, scaling the walls there in the Capitol on January 6th, but you know, there are deeply within their own ranks some deep support for this radical neo-fascist politics and movement. And they're also quite concerned, I think, that, you know, those forces are deeply embedded in the police and even in the lower ranks of the military. They're not going to tell us how deep that is. You know, they're going to keep that pretty much under wraps here. But I believe that, you know, they are shaken here with what's happened. And that's not gone away. And the radical right, I think, is emboldened by what happened on January 6th. I think they see that as a model, at least, you know, the oath changers, oath takers, three percenters, and so forth. They'll see that as a model, and you're going to see that more at a local level, but not right away. I think things will calm down, and they'll look for another opportunity, maybe for the entire year, but you'll see this thing begin to reemerge, I think, next year before the midterm elections, right?
So, Jack, do you think that Trump can continue to control the Republican Party, or will the traditional Republicans get control?
Well, that's the $24,000 question here. And I think what you've been seeing is a fight for control of the Republican Party. You've got certain traditional forces that are going after Trump, which I predicted would happen after he left office. But at the same time, you see Trump maneuvering to hold on to control of the party, and we will see in the next 3 to 6 months, you know, who prevails in that regard. So it's a fight for control of the Republican Party here that's going on deeply behind the scenes that will play out over some time. And it's hard to say which will prevail. You know, Trump, who has a lot of legitimacy with tens of millions of his supporters out there, and the elites that were aligned with him, and the money bags that were behind him and those elites. You know, I mean, there's not much talk of that, but you know, who's been fueling all this right wing effort? You know, institutionally for voter suppression and gerrymandering, and all at the state level, and certain forces here, you know, the Cruises, the Hawleys, and so forth at the national level. Who's been funding this? Well, there are people who are behind this. You know, one very obvious is the Mercer family of Texas that have been pumping money into the Bannions and Breitbart and Parler and all these sources. For some time here, they're not going to go away, and they're kind of the final word on what strategy is probably going to be followed here in the future. So you know, those forces, all of them, from the money bags down to the street level radicals, are all out there, and they're not going away, and they're probably going to regroup now and figure out what they're going to do next. I don't see them doing much immediately, but with that close a margin in Congress, you know, between the parties here, Republicans, you know, in the House, only 11 votes, and when they do the census changes, Democrats will even have fewer than 11 votes next midterm election, and of course it's 50-50 in the Senate. I think they've lost some forces, some of them on the fence that were supporting Trump and the right-wing movements have, opportunistically switched to the traditional elite. You know, a good example is McConnell. But, you know, the fight is still on in the institutions and outside in middle America, you know, heartland America, as to who's going to control that party. And we'll see. We'll just have to keep a watch on that, I think.
Professor, speaking of demands, what demands, democratic, economical, transitional, should socialists be making now?
Oh, well, you know, it's a ripe environment for raising these demands. Some of the economic demands are already out there, you know, like Medicare for all, free college tuition, expunged student debt, $15 minimum wage. By the way, should be $23 if workers got their share of productivity since the 1970s. You know, those are all good demands already out there, but, you know, others need to be added to them. One of the demands I've been raising is that let people collect Social Security at 3/4 of their pay at age 55. That would open a lot of jobs to young folks and give people a decent way to retire. Repeal the 2018 Trump tax cuts, which were $4 trillion, not the announced $1.5 trillion. A financial transaction tax on banks and financial institutions, and the loopholes for pharma and tech and so forth. We need a $4 trillion infrastructure bill here if we want to be serious about infrastructure. So there's, and the government corporate investment tax, you know, to really move on alternative energy. There are a lot of economic demands out there that are, you know, easily understood as deeply necessary that people would really be appealed to. Democratic demands, again, obviously abolish that racist electoral college. That's clearly number one. A simple majority vote in the Senate, no filibusters. Restore the Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. Institutionalize nationwide mail-in ballot voting. The Republicans are going to go after that, you know, because that's one reason why they lost. There needs to be nationwide mail-in ballot voting. I've talked about the Federal Reserve, that those governors should be elected. They should not be appointed by the banks, which mostly they are, vetted by the banks, right? we should expand the U.S. House of Representatives. You know, the Constitution says as the population grows, you're supposed to expand the House of Representatives. The fact that we haven't since 1913 has enabled, along with gerrymandering and voter suppression, the Trump and right-wing forces to essentially take over the red states. And that's a big problem that we have in Congress, because they dominate those red states, you know, by those means. But if you expanded the House of Representatives, the population centers in the cities would have greater representation. We need to get rid of gerrymandering and voter suppression. We need a new War Powers Act, so only Congress and Congress can't delegate those powers to the president. Right? We need to get rid of this tyranny called presidential pardons. You know, we're all supposed to be above the law, but not really. So there's a whole host of democratic demands that need to be raised here, not just economic demands. So, you know, those are some of the things I would advocate.
Jack Rasmus, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately. But before we have to say goodbye, let me ask you, how can people follow your work?
Well, you know, my blog is probably the best place. I write an extended article a week. That's simply jackrasmus.com. JackRasmus.com. From there, you can get to my website and, you know, the longer postings and so forth. You can find out my books and et cetera. Follow me on Twitter every day. You know, things that are of import, I think. You know, I post those on Twitter. That's at Dr. Jack Rasmus. And then my own radio show, Alternative Visions, on the Progressive Radio Network every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. You can follow my my verbal commentary there. Those are probably the best sources.
Great. Well, it's been very enlightening to have you on Law and Disorder, Jack. Thank you so much for being our guest, and we wish you all the best in the future. We'll get you back. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.